Many years ago, before I was ordained as a monk, I believed that wisdom came from experience. So I left my home country of England for India, roaming around and gathering life experience in Europe and Asia. The more difficult it was, the more I liked it, because I felt that difficulties helped me to know myself better, and that was beneficial to my life. But the overland trip to India was a little disappointing. It was not as challenging as I expected, and so on the way back, I resolved to travel from Pakistan to England without any money. I wondered if it would be possible to hitchhike all the way back, and I also wanted to know how it would feel to have nothing at all. It was quite an adventure. Several occasions I will never forget. I would like to tell you about one of them. By the time I arrived in Tehran, the capital city of Iran, I was exhausted. I was as thin as a stick. My clothes were all dirty and crumpled, and I must have looked pretty awful. I was shocked when I saw myself in the mirror of a public restroom. As for my mind, it was more and more like that of a hungry ghost, constantly worrying about food. Will I get anything to eat today or not? Whether my stomach would be empty or full depended on the kindness of fellow human beings. I had to rely on my parami because there was nothing else to rely on. Then I met an Iranian man who felt sorry for me and also saw a chance to practice his English. He treated me to a cup of tea and gave me a small amount of money. At night, I slept on the street, hidden in a small, quiet alley. I was afraid that policemen would beat me up if they found me. In the morning, I walked to a soup shop that I remembered served free bread. While I was walking along the street, trying not to look at the tempting restaurants in the corner of my eyes and not to smell the aroma that lingered in the air, I noticed a woman walking toward me. She looked stunned when she saw me. She stopped in her tracks, stared for a moment, then walked up to me with a scowl on her face. Using sign language, she told me to follow her, and being a seeker of experience, I did. After walking for about 10 minutes, we reached a townhouse and rode an elevator to the fourth floor. I assumed we were going to her apartment, but she still had not said a single word. No friendly smile, just a fierce face. Once the door was opened, I saw it was indeed her apartment. She took me to the kitchen and pointed to a chair, signaling me to sit down. Then she brought me many kinds of food. I felt as if I were in heaven. It made me realize that the most delicious food in the world is the food you eat when you're truly hungry and your stomach is growling. The woman called out to her son and said something to him which I couldn't understand, but I noticed that he was around my age. The son came back after a while with a pair of pants and a shirt. When she saw that I'd finished eating, the woman pointed to the bathroom and signaled me to bathe and change into the new clothes. I guess she planned to burn my old ones. She didn't smile at all, said nothing, and made herself understood with sign language. While bathing, I thought that maybe this lady saw in me her own son and was thinking, what if my son traveled to a foreign country and had a hard time like this? What if he was in such a pitiful situation? What would that be like? I thought that she must have helped me with a mother's love. I decided to appoint her my honorary Persian mother and smiled to myself alone in that bathroom. When I was ready, the woman took me back to the spot where we met and left me there. She merged back into the stream of people who were walking to work. I stood there watching her disappear into the crowd, and deep inside knew that I would never forget her in my entire life. I was very moved and my eyes were teary. She gave so much to me, even though we didn't know each other at all. I was as skinny as a dried corpse. My clothes were dirty and smelly, and my hair was long and messy. But she didn't mind that at all. She even took me into her house and took as good care of me as if I was her own son, without expectation of anything at all in return, not even a word of thanks. It has been over 20 years now, and I would like to publicly extol the virtue of this sulky-faced bodhisattva so that everyone will know that even in a big city, there are still good people, and there may be more good people than we think. This woman was not the only good-hearted person I met. I received kindness and help from people in many countries while I was traveling and collecting life experience, even though I did not ask anyone for anything. It made me determine in my mind that in future, If I was in a position to help others in the same kind of way, I would. I wanted to help to sustain the spirit of human kindness in the world. Society can seem a hard and heartless place sometimes, but I thought we can each try to be at least a small oasis in the desert. I didn't get all the way back to England. I lost my passport near the Turkish border and returned to Tehran where I made friends and got a job teaching English. After a few months, with some money in my pocket, I returned to India. My 19th birthday found me living by the side of a lake with a Hindu monk. He was an inspiring teacher whose practices were similar to Buddhism, and he taught me many things. While I stayed with him, I had plenty of time to contemplate my life. In the afternoon, I liked to climb up a nearby mountain, sit under an old tree, and enjoy the breeze. Looking down to the lake below and the desert that expanded all the way to the horizon allowed me to think clearly. One day, my mind became full of questions. Why was it that whereas I was so impressed every time I remembered the kindness of the people who had helped me during my journey, those who gave me food or shelter for a night or two, I'd never felt the same way about the kindness of my parents? They'd looked after me for 18 years, given me food every single day, 3 or 4 times a day, and they'd still worried that the food might not be delicious enough for me. They'd given me both clothes and shelter. They'd taken me to a doctor when I was sick, and when I was ill, they'd seemed to suffer more than I did. Why was I never impressed with that? I suddenly felt that I'd been shamefully unjust. I realized how much I'd taken them for granted. At that moment, it was as if a dam burst. Many examples of my parents' boon kun, their generosity and kindness, came to my mind, so overwhelming, so impressive. That was the beginning of my gratitude towards my parents. I continued to imagine how difficult it must have been for my mother when she was pregnant. At the beginning, she must have had morning sickness, and later on, it would have been difficult for her to walk. All kinds of movement must have been cumbersome and painful. But she accepted the suffering because she believed that there was something worthwhile in it, and that something was me. When I was young, I had to depend on my parents for everything, but why did I feel indifferent, as if it was their duty to give me to give and my right to receive? After a while, I realized that I gained the opportunity to practice Buddhism in order to develop a true inner refuge, because my parents had provided me with a stable, dependable external refuge when I was young. They had given me a strong foundation for my heart to take on the battle with the defilements. When I was 20 years old, I traveled to Thailand to be ordained as a Buddhist monk. My parents made no objections because they wanted their son to live his life the way he wanted to be happy, he wanted, and to be happy. My parents chose this over their own hopes for me. Last year, my mother confessed to me that the day I left home was the saddest day of her life. I was very moved by this. What impressed me the most was the fact that she had been very patient and concealed this suffering from me for 20 years because she didn't want me to feel bad about it. After I became a monk, sometimes I couldn't help reproaching myself. While I lived with my parents, every day I'd had the opportunity to do things for them in return for their love and hardly ever did so. Now I had the desire to express my sense of gratitude in tangible ways but could not. I was a monk and lived thousands of miles away from them. What a pity. And yet, I could do what monks have done for over 2,000 years and sent them thoughts of loving kindness every day. In Thailand, we regularly refer to the boon kun of parents. There is no exact equivalent to this concept of boon kun in the English language, but we may explain it to mean the belief that whenever we receive kindness or assistance from anyone, especially when it is given freely, we incur certain obligations. A good person is one who honors those obligations, and the deepest of those obligations is to our parents. The Buddha taught us to develop both a deep appreciation of the debt of gratitude we owe to our parents and the intention to repay it as best we can. This is not a value that I was brought up with. In Western cultures, there is, of course, love and attachment between parents and children, but generally speaking, the sense of mutual obligation is much weaker. Values such as independence and individual freedom are given more weight. A special, profound bond between parents and children may be felt by many, but it is not articulated as a moral standard that upholds the society as it is in Buddhist cultures like Thailand. The importance we give to the bunkun of parents may be traced to the Buddha's teachings on mundane right view, the basis for understanding what's what in our lives. In the Pali texts, the Buddha says that we should believe that our father is real and our mother is real. Are you confused as you read this? Why did the Buddha think he had to tell us that? Isn't it obvious? Who doesn't know that we've been born into this world because we have truly existing parents? The thing to understand here is that these words are idiomatic. What the Buddha is saying is that we need to believe that there is a special significance in the relationship between parents and children, a significance that we should acknowledge and honor. The relationship between parents and children is mysterious and profound. The Buddha teaches us that there is no heavier karma than to kill one's mother or father. In Pali, it is called anantariya karma. Karma is so heinous that its terrible results cannot be avoided, no matter how sincere the perpetrator's regret might be. So whereas Angulimala could become an arhat despite having killed 999 people, it would have been impossible if he had killed just one person, if that one person had been either his mother or father. The Buddha did not teach the profundity of this relationship merely as a skillful means to promote family values. It is a timeless truth that he discovered and then revealed for the benefit of the human race. It is an important Buddhist principle that the relationship between our parents and us is deep and profound, and probably has been going on for many lifetimes. Hence, we should accept, respect, and care about this relationship. We might say, in summary, that in this lifetime we are resuming unfinished business with our parents. In some cases, this unresolved state of affairs may manifest in a bad way, such as when a baby is abandoned by its parents, or a child is physically or sexually abused by a parent. There are such cases, and there seem to be more every day. But the terrible things that some parents can do to their children do not disprove this special relationship. The present lifetime is just one scene of a long drama, and we do not know what has happened in the past. As a caring society, we should of course do everything we can to protect children from abuse, to make clear how unacceptable we find it, and to deal with guilty parents according to the law of the land. But at the same time, we may protect our minds from anger and despair by reminding ourselves that we are seeing one small segment of a complex saga, largely hidden from our eyes. Considering this truth, perhaps victims of abuse may be able to find their way to forgiveness for all involved. Fortunately, there are very few parents who are completely evil to their children. Most are, as the texts say, like Brahma gods towards them, motivated by unwavering love, compassion, and sympathetic joy. In a number of discourses, the Buddha teaches us how to return our parents' profound beneficence. One of the best known is the teaching called the Six Directions, which the Buddha taught to a young man named Sigalaka. A part of this teaching states that, in five ways, young householder, a child should minister to his parents as the east, saying to himself, having been supported by them, I will support them in my turn. Two, I will help them with their work. Three, I will keep up the honor and the traditions of my family. Four, I will make myself worthy of my heritage. Five, I will make offerings, dedicating merit to them after their death. Digha Nikaya 3, 189 to 192. The teachings in this discourse reflect the ideal structure of a Buddhist society. The emphasis is on people's responsibilities towards one another, on duties rather than rights. Nowadays, it is heartening to reflect on how many people in Thailand try to practice according to the principles above. But there is another discourse that I would like to refer to here, one that is less well-known and less practiced. In this discourse, the Buddha said that even if a child were to put his or her mother on one shoulder and the father on the other shoulder, carry them around for 100 years, provide them with well-prepared food that they enjoy, bathe and massage them, allow them to excrete and urinate on their shoulder, or give them huge sums of money, provide them with a high standing and powerful position. Even if the child does all this for their parents, he or she will still be unable to adequately repay them for all that they have done for their child. However, if the parents have little or no faith in the Dhamma, and if a child can help to arouse the parents' faith, or if the parents do not practice the five precepts or practice them inconsistently, and if a child can help improve the parents' moral conduct, or if a child can make stingy parents delight in giving and helping others, or help parents develop the wisdom to overcome mental defilements and end suffering, the child who succeeds in these tasks can be said to have truly repaid the debt of gratitude that he owes to his parents. There are many points to ponder in this discourse. I believe the Buddha taught it tongue in cheek. If you don't think so, just try to picture yourself feeding your parents while they sit on your shoulders. No need to think about 100 years. You probably wouldn't be able to take their weight for 5 minutes. Some mothers, I'm thinking of my own here, wouldn't want to get up there in the first place in case they fell down and broke an arm or leg. I think the Buddha used such hyperbole because he wanted us to reflect that, wow, even if I was to do unbelievable things like that, it wouldn't be enough, let alone what I do for them now. He wanted us to see that this is a huge debt. No matter how hard we look after our parents in the normal ways, it is only as if we were paying back the interest on the debt. When we are in debt, the owner of the debt is not interested in how much we have paid off in the past, but how much remains to be paid in the future. Similarly, in considering our debt to our parents, rather than remembering all the things that we've done already, we should think about what remains, what we haven't done yet. The debt we owe to our parents is not an ordinary debt. It is a sacred obligation. The Buddha teaches us that besides the serving of our parents as laid down in the 6 directions, a Buddhist should try to encourage his parents in all that is good. The child should seek to become a Kalyanamitta, or good friend, to his parents. Here we may see more clearly that the idea of a Buddhist society is of one where people try to be good friends to one another. Parents should try to be good friends to their children, and children should try to be good friends to their parents. An older sibling should try to be a good friend to a younger one, and a younger sibling should try to be a good friend to an older sibling. A husband should try to be a good friend to his wife, and a wife should try to be a good friend to her husband. We should help each other in the task of reducing the negative emotions in our hearts and working together to create a life and a society based upon loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom. In the discourse I've mentioned above, the Buddha singled out 4 virtues. I would like to repeat them now and expand upon their meaning. Saddha, faith, is the belief that the Buddha is a perfectly enlightened being, that his teachings are true, and that the Buddha's teachings will result in liberation for those who practice them seriously. It is the belief that there are people who have practiced the Buddha's teachings well and become liberated by them. It is the belief that of all the beings in the universe, this group of noble liberated beings is the most worthy of respect. It is the belief that, as human beings, we control our own fate. Whether things will be good or bad, whether we experience happiness or suffering, is up to us. Our lives do not depend on any spirit, ghost, angel, God, or divine power, but depend on our own actions of body, speech, and mind, both in the past and, most importantly, in the present. Saddha means, in essence, faith in our potential for enlightenment, and the conviction that the most important thing a human should get from his or her life is freedom from suffering and its causes. Sila, virtue or precepts, is the beauty and nobility of conduct. It refers to the ability to refrain from saying or doing anything that harms oneself or others. Sila is liberation from bad karma created through body and speech. Sila is stable when protected by an intelligent sense of shame with regard to unwholesome actions, hiri, and an intelligent fear of the karmic consequences of such actions, otapa. Sila provides the necessary moral standard for those who are determined to grow in the Dhamma. Chaga, generosity or renunciation. refers to detachment from material things, delight in generosity, charity, and helping others. People with chaga are kind and caring, not stingy or self-aggrandizing. Panya, wisdom, is the kind of knowing that extinguishes suffering and the defilements that cause it. Human beings are vulnerable to suffering at all times, even though nobody wants to suffer even the slightest amount. We suffer because we do not understand how suffering arises and how it ceases. Why don't we understand? Because we don't understand ourselves, and we are not trying to understand as much as we could. As long as we don't understand ourselves, we will always be a victim of our emotions. It's like being in a dark room with a cobra. Would it be possible to walk around in such a room without being bitten by the cobra? It would be hard enough to avoid bumping into the furniture. Panya, in the initial stage, works on the level of perception. It is a function of the memories that we accumulate from hearing, listening, and reading the Dhamma. We condition our emotions, both good and bad, with perception and ideation. Those who listen to and remember the Dhamma can reflect on it until they understand, and then they can cultivate the path of skillful consideration. Having trained in this way, then, when the mind falls into an unwholesome state, it does not become completely overwhelmed. It doesn't fall into a rut. It quickly rights itself. When someone who has never studied the Dhamma is treated badly, for example, they will usually become angry and depressed. But one who has studied the Dhamma may bring to mind the reflection that even the Buddha himself was the subject of abuse and denigration. And so why should we be exempt from it? This thought can lead to an acceptance of the situation. By recollecting wise reflections, we can start to let go of negative emotions and start to wean ourselves away from the refuge of alcohol and pills. This level of panya discriminates between good and bad, the beneficial and the harmful. It gives us a peaceful and realistic vision of our life and the world. But it is not an infallible refuge, especially when strong emotions have arisen. A higher level of panya is the wisdom that provides knowledge and understanding in the mind of those who have pure sila and stable samadhi. At this level, wisdom is no longer a thought. It is much faster than thoughts, like a supersonic airplane flying faster than sound. Wisdom is to clearly see all things as they are, to the point that we no longer enjoy attaching to them as me or mine. This is the wisdom that utterly penetrates the truth that everything, including our thoughts and feelings, belongs to nature and has no owner. It is the wisdom to realize that our life is not a fort in a barren land, but it is a river that flows calmly through the garden of the world. When we develop the wisdom to see this, we can let go. The Buddha taught that encouraging faith, virtuous conduct, generosity, and wisdom in one's parents' hearts is the highest service to them, but he did not overlook the more basic kinds of service. He taught that a good child should take care of their parents. Taking care of parents starts with material items, but does not end there. Giving material gifts or providing comfort is a symbol of love, but it is not a proof of love and certainly shouldn't be a substitute for it. The way that daughters and sons relate to their parents varies from family to family, since it depends on many factors. For example, how many children there are in the family, their age, whether they are still living at home or elsewhere, near or far away, etc. When parents get old, a good son or daughter helps to take care of them. If it is really not practical to do so, and not just a lame excuse, then they should go visit their parents often, or at least call or write regularly to ask after them and tell their parents about what is going on in their lives. To know that their children miss and care about them is a medicine that gives parents peace of mind and can be a medicine more effective than those they may receive from their doctor. We give our parents what we can give. It is wonderful if we can pay the medical bills when our parents are sick, but if we are poor and cannot afford such help, then we should give what we do have, such as time, sitting with them, reading for them, or nursing them as best we can. For example, giving them a massage, bathing them, or feeding them. These things may be more valuable to our parents than any material gift or money. The discourse I quoted above tells us that the greatest factor conditioning the happiness and suffering in our lives are thoughts and emotions, or in other words, the mind itself. It is for this reason that the Buddha says that it is a great merit for those who can help their parents to develop wholesome qualities and experience happy, joyous mental states. It is a kind of giving that enables our parents to gain a priceless gift. It is good and feels good to give material gifts to our parents and to give them treats, to take them out for meals or to take them on holiday, for example. But these kinds of gifts are always somewhat limited. Material things in particular can break down and fall apart and can even be a cause of such anxiety for the elderly that they become a double-edged sword. The support and care given to parents can only help them in this lifetime. The Buddha said that in addition to these praiseworthy ways of showing our love and gratitude to our parents, we should not overlook their spiritual welfare. Good qualities that arise in the hearts of our parents have no drawbacks. They're not dependent on external conditions, nobody can steal them, and they provide provisions for the next life. For this reason, the Buddha calls the inner virtues a noble treasure or noble wealth. They are noble because they are the means to attain the true nobility of complete freedom from suffering. We should provide as much happiness and comfort to our benefactors as we can, but at the same time, we should not forget what lies beyond that. Mitigating the suffering our parents endure in their wandering through the samsaric realm is still inferior to reducing its root causes. To summarize, the Buddhist principles regarding how we honor the debt of kindness we owe to our parents depends on our beliefs that 1. Continual rebirth is painful, suffering, and the freedom from the cycle of rebirth is true happiness. 2. Rebirth is conditioned by defilements, kilesa. 3. Humans can let go of defilements, and they should do so. 4. Letting go of defilements and cultivating good qualities is the practice leading to true happiness.
Is it possible for a monastic to look after their parents while still practicing the vinaya? Or
it's very dodgy. It's very dodgy, very difficult. Ajahn V did. Ajahn Viradhamma did. And it was complicated. I don't think he'd recommend it to everybody. He had about 30 years as a monk before trying to do it. That helped. It's like, without good 25, 30 years of understanding what the practice is about, how to maneuver in the world. But there's, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Liam, what they did, and have their mothers come and ordain as nuns. Live in monastery.
Ajahn Dunn's father ordained?
Ajahn Dunn's father ordained. Yeah, Ajahn Dunn's father ordained and lived at his monastery. That was a coup. So there's different ways that it's accomplished. Also with Ajahn Jayasaro, now that he's say well established as a teacher, and people make offerings of how can I help, and he'll tend to go and visit his home, and then he'll bring her out. He's been bringing her out to Thailand. I think last year was probably the last time he figured she can't really travel anymore. Too difficult. The last time she came, she has very serious back problems, a lot of pain. And the last many years, then people who know Ajahn Jayasaro have gone, picked up his mom, traveled with her to bring her to Thailand. It was the last time they stopped in Kuwait or something, and broke up the journey so that she could rest in between Gajan Jayasaro and Netter in Kuwait, and they travel back to Thailand again. There's this picture of Ajahn Jayasaro sent to me of him walking down the street in Kuwait and he's dressed as a Buddhist monk. And then there's these two women in burqas, and you can sort of say, which ones are the strange ones? And he was obviously the weird one. But somebody got that picture, like somebody who was with him and got that picture. He loved that picture. Because they waited for him to go past him. And they got, what the heck? Somebody else caught the picture. So there's different ways of doing it. But I think of other examples.
My friend Uwapa, taking care of his mother. Yeah, he had to break an eye by driving her to the hospital and things like that.
Right.
Using the Burmese tradition.
Yeah.
Difficult.
Yeah, so our vinaya keeps us pretty much grounded in something that's not the world. And that's wonderful. But there's usually kind of alternate ways of actually accomplishing that. It just takes a bit of thinking.
My parents, at this time, much of my extended family are in good health. When I went and visited them, or when I interacted with them, it's been pretty clear that, like, even though I'm here doing this, and it's very different, when I go back with my parents especially, but other family members, it's like I'm still the young son or the little cousin.
Oh, yeah.
And so I found myself sort of, in that situation where I feel like maybe, in other contexts around here, it's like the ability to offer a wisdom or anything like that is severely limited.
Yeah, it's pretty much non-existent.
Yeah. So maybe can you provide some guidance on how to navigate those situations?
Well, a lot of it is just the patience, keep your mouth shut. and just smile a lot. Get your butt back to the monastery. but the thing is that what happens is it starts to sink in over time. Because they think it's you're just doing something weird while you're young, and it's like in the talk last night. So just always trying to run away from reality. But as their life changes and they see things that are really out of their control, like bring dukkha, and then when they start to suffer in different ways or kind of get jolted in some way, then it clicks. Oh, I have that son in a monastery. And he said something about this one time. and you have to slip it in, actually. You have to be really, really attentive and alert and being able to keep back without pushing anything on. But then when the opportunity arises, how do you slip something in that will plant a seed? And then it does happen, comes to fruition. Like, And I have a few of my aunts and uncles who are very respectful of what I'm doing. And when they see me, then they'll ask questions. And you know, it's not, they're never going to be meditators or Buddhists. They realize that I'm a resource that they don't have access to in any other way. And say, like my siblings in general are completely disinterested, but they all respect what I'm doing. And I think if something came up and that was really difficult, they really lead very ordinary lives. Nothing. They seem to be incredibly blessed with pretty smooth lives.
Allison has taken a couple of your retreats.
Yeah, she's done like 3 retreats with me. Yeah,
when
my
Bruce
sister.
Was here, he, when Bruce was here, he made a point of coming to morning pujas.
He was here for everything. I was shocked. He was here, morning pujas. He was here. He wanted to be here for chanting, meditation. He wanted to do everything. He wanted to go on alms round. He wanted to do everything. All I wanted him to do was operate a little excavator. That was what I meant. I invited him to come down. That was the hook that I said, yeah, I can come down and do something. Because, you know, just to show up, it would be. Because he did try to come last year, but turned away at the border. Couldn't get past immigration. It's not too big of a threat for U.S. national security.
So it's more like being an example, so to speak. Like when I visit my mom, if there's a bug or a spider or something, I try and sweep it up and put it outside. And she's gotten to the point where as she kills the bug, she says, "Sorry, didn't you spit it up?"
That's something already. Sort of that kind of thought would never enter in my family's life. So just it just doesn't, you know, think. But then it's in a whole new perspective, which is really, that's a gift.
I think, you know, too, like what you're kind of saying is like just having faith in the training that we do.
Yeah.
You know, like we go back, like we're not totally abandoning being monks, you know, so we still keep Arv and I. And like, yeah. Remember the first time I came back as a monk, it's like, you know, of course they're doing their whole family thing. And so it's like when they were having the dinner, I just snuck into the kitchen and did the dishes. And then, you know, it's kind of like just what Ajahn Jesar was saying, you know, it's sort of like you kind of feel this sort of regret, like you didn't give back to your parents and stuff like that. And so, and I remember I woke up one morning and there had been this huge windstorm. It was the same trip, and there's been this huge rainstorm or windstorm, and the whole front yard was covered in branches. And I just looked out, and, you know, I said, "Oh, my dad's, you know, I know he's going to go out and pick all those up." And so as soon as he left, I just went out and picked them all up. And then he pulled in the driveway just as I was picking up the last branch, and the expression on his face was worth all the effort, because he was like, you know, he didn't even ask me to do it, you know. But it was something that needed to be done, so I just did it, and that was part of the training here. And so I wasn't like thinking like I want to go and impress them or try to make an impression on them, but it's just because that's what we do here. So
different situation here. My parents are
your parents. It's a whole different realm.
So my parents are Buddhists. They go, you know, they go to meditation groups, all of that. I'm curious, you know, the one thing, but like most American Buddhists, you know, mundane right view is not total, is not all there, which is, you know, that's quite normal. But what I find myself, well, I'm interested in if you have any, I find myself kind of nudging them, you know, in that direction. But I also notice I'm curious, I'd like to really be able to sort of, purify the motivation there, because there's part of it is just, you know, you want people to think the way you do because that makes you more comfortable. And that is an impure motivation. It's not going to be helpful. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, I think one of the things is that really reflecting on one's motivation, which is really good in the sense of, because it's easy to sort of, you know, I'm right and they're wrong. And you try to get them to be right. But, especially in relationship to parents, it really doesn't work. But I think that sense of reflection in terms of parents and that sense of compassion that one wants to help in some way. And that's where you have to be willing to wait and be alert to an opening, and then see how it lands, rather than waiting for an opening and, you know, going at, you know, like a bull terrier. it's really, okay, what would be useful? And a lot of it is that, because you want to be able to give a reflection that would stimulate their own reflection. Because you want it for it to come from their own. And it's one of the things that Ajahn Chah was incredibly skilled at, was teaching you in a way that made you think you figured it out yourself. And that's really, really important. So it's sort of like, just sort of like planting a seed that makes people reflect and investigate.
That reminds me of something in the Tao Te Ching about leaders, where it says that a good leader, a righteous leader, leads by righteousness, and everybody follows them and knows they're the leader. But a great leader teaches people, and then everyone benefits, and they all look at each other and say, wow, we did it all completely by ourselves.
Okay.